Welcome to the podcast of the Student Christian Movement. SCM is a community of students, past and present, and it is community that is at the heart of who we are and how we do things. Based in the UK, our vision of SCM is as a generous community, expressing a lived faith in Jesus Christ where social action meets prayerful devotion. We seek to be both a radical voice for equality and justice, and a safe home for progressive Christian students. Hello and welcome back to the SCM podcast. Today I'm very excited to have Andrew Clark Howard with us. So Andrew and I met for the first time in Cambridge this year in August because we both have chapters that are coming out in the upcoming book, Awake, Emerging and Connected with SCM Press. We had some very good conversations about some of his thought on Bonhoeffer, and so I thought it would be great to have him on the podcast today. So Andrew, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, nice. Thanks so much for having me. It's really exciting to get to talk more and connect as well. And I think this is exciting conversations you're having here.
Definitely. So first of all, for those who don't know you, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, what it is that you do? That would be great to hear.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, I mean, there are really two ways that I can introduce myself. One is a pretty typical way that I would in a Western setting. My name is Andrew. I'm married to a wonderful person called Steph. I live in Australia. I'm a PhD student at a university here, and I'm working on a thesis on the theology of Dietrich Bonhoeffer. But there's also another way to introduce myself, and I think that it's a way that relates to a lot of the conversations I'm trying to have with Bonhoeffer and my own context. It would be a way to locate myself in a context like an Indigenous one. It would be to identify my ancestors who came from the British Isles, predominantly Scotland, but also England. They all left at various points during the height of the British Empire, and they relocated in the colonies that Britain had garnered. South Africa, mostly. I was born in South Africa, but also to New Zealand. I had some ancestors go between the two, and then my family originally and eventually landed in the late 90s in New Zealand. I'd also want to therefore acknowledge the landmarks of that place, Rangitoto, Amonga, the mountain that I grew up with under, Waitemata, which is an ocean, a body of water. And I therefore honour also the mana whenua of Tāmaki Makaurau, the Māori tribes whose land I grew up on in Auckland, New Zealand, which is the, you know, colonizer's name for these places. So that's a little bit about me and my story, what I do, but also why I'm here and, who I am.
Yeah, that's great. I really enjoyed when you did that introduction in Cambridge as well of introducing yourself. Mm. I believe it's referred to as the Wakapapa. Is that correct?
Yeah. Wakapapa or Whakapapa, depends what part of the country you're from, is how you pronounce that WH. It was really interesting to do it in a place like Cambridge too. That I think I mentioned that they're the first Māori dictionary, the first language dictionary of the Indigenous language in New Zealand, was edited at Cambridge by a scholar there, whose name I'm forgetting, but who had travelled back with British missionaries. So, it's interesting sorts of connections when you speak of these things, when you speak of different languages and speak of different ways of relating to each other.
Definitely. So you've already mentioned that you're currently doing your doctoral work on Bonhoeffer, but you've also produced a number of other works that are related to his life and theology. That includes your article, The Architecture of Transcendence, which is where you consider John Webster and Bonhoeffer's theology of divine agency and Christology, and another article titled Against the Finished Man in the Church, Whiteness, Theological Practice, and the Differentiated Body of Christ, which is where you put Bonhoeffer into conversation with the theology of Willie Jennings regarding whiteness and Bonhoeffer's idea of a differentiated body. And finally, you have a chapter that's due to be published in the upcoming book that I've already mentioned, Awake, Emerging and Connected, Theologies of Justice from the Missing Generation. And that is titled The View from Below, from Above. So we'll discuss all of this in more depth throughout the podcast, but for our listeners, when did you first encounter Bonhoeffer and why were you drawn to write about his work?
like many, I think, who grew up Christian or grew up around the church, I sort of knew of Bonhoeffer as this heroic Christian leader. But it was really during my undergrad studies, I was actually drawn to his ecclesiology. Most people are drawn to Bonhoeffer's works like Discipleship, Life Together. I think the first thing I'd probably read of him was Sanctorum Communio, his quite famously dense PhD dissertation, which I did not understand at all. But I read other people who read about that book and about Bonhoeffer's idea of the church as this place where sort of divine and human are considered together, where the visible body of the church is the place where Jesus sort of is working. I found that really interesting, and that was kind of what drew me into his theology initially. And I think sort of resonates with a lot of questions I'm interested today, that piece you mentioned on Jennings, you know, thinking about the bodily nature of our life together. It's something that I think Bonhoeffer is just really fun to read on. Yeah,
but you're correct. A very interesting place to start with Bonhoeffer going to his dissertation straight away.
Like I said, I promise that wasn't a flex. I picked it up from the library and I was like, this is great. I'm going to figure out, you know, all the questions about the doctrine of the church that have ever been asked, and then, you know, get a few pages into it and think, this is not written for someone like me. But, you know, I think I know a little bit more about it now, but it's...
Yeah. It would be easy to read that as your first encounter with Bonhoeffer and then go, nah, not for me.
Yeah. Especially because it's the first book, you think, okay, I'll work chronologically. And it's like, no, it's like, you know, reading the Bible chronologically, every New Year's resolution, sort of getting stuck up in Leviticus. It's, you know, better ways to do it maybe, but
and there's definitely different developments in Bonhoeffer's writing as you get to his later work, that's definitely more mature, that's more thought out, and it's good to be able to contrast those and look at that. But starting with some of the basic concepts, what is Bonhoeffer referring to when he talks about this view from below that you mention in your upcoming chapter?
So the view from below, it comes from this series of brief reflections, a very good series of reflections to read as a first thing if you're interested in Bonhoeffer, called After 10 Years. It was published usually alongside his famous letters and papers from prison, these sort of writings he wrote during his imprisonment in World War II. But it was actually written just before his imprisonment as a Christmas gift to some of his fellow dissidents, some of the people he was working with who were resisting Nazism. And at the end of this series of reflections called After 10 Years, he wrote these words. I thought it'd be helpful to read them out. It remains an experience of incomparable value that we have for once learned to see the great events of world history from below, from the perspective of the outcasts, the suspects, the maltreated, the powerless, the oppressed and reviled, in short, from the perspective of the suffering. This is kind of what Bonhoeffer calls the view from below. He titles this little brief section "The View from Below." It's a really interesting passage, a pretty powerful one. And those sort of familiar with the shape of 20th century theology after 1945, it sounds pretty similar to something a liberation theologian might say. You know, it has this resonance of God's option for the poor, the idea that God is hidden in the suffering and the dispossessed of the world, and in the outcast and the suspect. But I think also when we come to this term in Bonhoeffer's work and what he means by it, it's also important to remember what he's saying, what he's not saying, and also who it's written for. He's writing this to some friends in the resistance who were very similar to him, kind of part of this class of people in German society, an educated sort of upper middle class who you know, lawyers, doctors, professors, these are the types of people he his family are, who he's living with. These are the types of people who are in the resistance, have connections in the political order of Germany, which means they can therefore resist in the way that they are. When he talks about the view from below, we should remember then he's talking about something of a view from above. He's experiencing suffering. He's experiencing injustice. We don't want to take away that from his own life, but he's experiencing those things as a sort of particular person of privilege too. And so in that way, it's a bit different from maybe a liberation theologian, option for the poor, even though there are kind of some resonances there.
Yeah, definitely. It's so interesting. One of my favorite parts of the chapter is where you take Bonhoeffer's concept of the proletariat Christ and you creatively recast it for today as the indigenous Christ. So where Bonhoeffer states that when the proletariat says that Jesus is a good human being, it means more than the bourgeoisie means when it says that Jesus is God. you rework this to say that when an Indigenous person says that Jesus is a good human being, it means more than when a colonizer says that Jesus is God. So can you speak a little more about what you mean by this and what are its implications, especially in relation to colonialism and Western settler theology?
Colonialism, like any structure of domination, something like capitalism, is one which structures the world in which we live in. It structures our ideologies, our ways of being together, it structures our religious communities. And there are a number of structures that formed Bonhoeffer's own context and endowed him with the privileges which he'd been given. One of those structures we will call the bourgeoisie, the structure of the bourgeois class. It's a landowning class that kind of comes to the fore in the early modern period in Europe, who, you know, to put it technically, derive their wealth from capital rather than labor. They are a type of people who own the means of production, a type of people who therefore have others working for them and exploit that work for the sake of their own benefit. I'm sure many listeners are kind of familiar with these basic concepts. And Bonhoeffer makes this really provocative claim, actually quite a bit earlier in his theology than The View from Below, just nearly 10 years earlier in a series of lectures he did in 1933, when, like you said, he talks about this idea that the proletariat identifying Jesus as a good human being is more significant than when the bourgeois, this endowed class of privilege and power, says that Jesus is God. This is so interesting because Bonhoeffer is very much a person committed to Christian orthodoxy, right? Like, Jesus is God is a pretty fundamental type of confession for Christians across history. And so that Jesus being a good human being, while also true, could risk sort of seeing Christ as this other form of religious teacher, not the incarnate Son of God, as Christianity has traditionally claimed that he is. And Bonhoeffer seems to play with these ideas by arguing that when one considers the positionality of those making them, whether they're a proletariat working in identifying Christ as a worker among workers, he says in this wider passage, in factory halls as the perfect idealist in politics, they name something more significant about God than the bourgeois class name God as Christ, but fail to see Christ in the working class communities that they're part of. And so, you know, I think there's an interesting anticipatory tone to this view, the view from below, this idea that, like, Christ is actually not to be seen in those colluded with power, in those who benefit from power, but actually, you know, within the suffering, within the oppressed of the world. I'm really interested in teasing that out in the context I live in today and thinking about capitalism as a system which is shaping Bonhoeffer's world. It shapes our world today, certainly, and the entanglements of colonialism and capitalism are, you know, important and interesting to tangle out. But if I was to consider Bonhoeffer's words in the context of settler colonialism, this particular form of social structure in which white folks such as myself and my ancestors come to other lands and settle, displace people who live there already and call it our own, what would it mean to sort of identify Christ as an Indigenous Christ? What would it mean to sort of upend those structures of power that have given form to my Christianity, and instead think of Jesus as among the dispossessed? Christ appears, Bonhoeffer suggests, not in places of power, not in the confessions of the powerful, but outside the boundaries set by bourgeois Christianity. And I think that's really interesting too. Boundaries are an important thing for settlers. What is okay and what isn't, what is licit and what is illicit in the New World is a very important question. And most of the time when settler Christians came to Indigenous people, they put a hard boundary on what it meant to be Christian, to say something like, to become Christian is to become white, to adopt white ways of being, white habits of existing, to leave behind Indigenous language, leave behind Indigenous culture. So if I'm trying to think of the fact that my own confessional tradition, my own implicit way of identifying Christ in the world is boundary by a structure of power, that Christ is an Indigenous Christ, that Christ sort of speaks among Indigenous people to white settlers, disrupts that entire sort of enterprise and causes me to reconsider the things that I've inherited and assumed. The Indigenous Christ sort of comes as a judgment, then we could say, of Christian colonial history. And of course, the Indigenous Christ is something that Maori communities, Aboriginal communities in Australia, something they've been grappling with for a long, long time. And when I say we, white theologians just haven't really been listening. So it's trying to sort of play a bit with what Bonhoeffer's doing there, but also consider what it would mean to think about those sets of relational and theological engagements in the context of settler colonialism today.
Yeah, and I think that call of the Indigenous crisis is a really necessary one, especially as we see a sort of resurgence of Westerners, especially in America and in Europe, trying to reclaim some form of Indigenous identity, whether that's Americans who are on tour to the UK trying to discover the Irish and Scottish roots, or whether that's Scottish people in the nationalist movement who are going back to like learning languages like Gaelic, which I mean I'm doing myself, but there's those people that use that as a way to deflect from their ancestors' involvement in colonial activity. Mm-hmm. There's a tendency, especially in Scotland, for people to give this idea that Scotland was colonized by England, when actually Scotland was one of the biggest players in the United Kingdom's colonial projects like round the globe. So there is this way in which there's that need for the Indigenous crisis to critique what's happening in the West just now.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you know, like I mentioned, I sort of knew most of my family tree, or part important bits of it. My dad is one of those white dads who loves family trees and writes them down. But I did like a DNA test to kind of confirm it. It was 70% from Scotland in particular, split between the Outer Hebrides and the Highlands as well. So, you know, my own ancestors, who might have left for very good reasons, who might have left for reasons to do with British rule, nonetheless came to new colonies benefiting from empire and benefiting from the displacement of Indigenous peoples, the stolen land that was given to them. So, these things are really, really difficult to pass out. And I think what I appreciate about what Bonhoeffer says is this idea that even sort of a bourgeois confession that Jesus is God is the wrong kind of confession. You know, for a Christian who does believe Jesus is God, that feels scary. That feels so completely other to the type of thing that I should expect to see. By attending to Indigenous voices on their own terms, without trying to make them familiar, without trying to draw them into sort of some type of confessional realm that makes sense to us, we're startled to just how deep and just how profound our participation in the structural violence of colonialism is. We come to see just how difficult it is to learn to speak of Christ today, because the things that have shaped us, the kind of social structures of our lives, the structures which created our faith, or at least that our faith participated in, so profoundly distort our vision to God's presence in the world and to, you know, a recognition of the dignity of the other.
Yeah, I think there's certainly a tendency for Western theologians to try and integrate Indigenous theologies or even liberation theologies into a Western way of rationalizing things, a very Enlightenment way of rationalizing theological systems. And it's something that I had a conversation with a few people about in Cambridge, was like, well, have you really read liberation theology unless you've read it in its original language? Because it loses a lot of the meaning when it's translated. But it's similar to one of the things that you mentioned in the Architecture of Transcendence. In that article, you talk about Bonhoeffer's critique of Enlightenment rationality and the process of theological naturalization. So with this in mind, and considering the insights you offer in both your upcoming chapter and your article on Willie Jennings, to what extent is Bonhoeffer both a part of the West's view from above, and where does he stand apart from it and critique it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, part of the reason I was drawn to Bonhoeffer, I did sort of my postgraduate work on Willie Jennings, and what's a particular sort of eye to my own identity as a settler person in New Zealand. But I was trying to think, like, what types of people do I want to learn from in this process of kind of forming a theological education? And Bonhoeffer struck out because I think he is someone from privilege, from power, who is trying to think really critically about this thing that he's inherited. He's trying to think critically throughout his work in different ways about kind of the liberal theology of his day, what that means for theology, for Christianity, for the shape of theology. But he's also trying to think sort of about this world come of age, right? He's trying to think about what it means to speak of Christ, to participate in the church, to do Christian things when those things kind of no longer have the same kind of meanings that they used to. I think that he gets some of the way in addressing that. I think there are really useful and interesting things Bonhoeffer has to say. I think I mentioned his ecclesiology is one kind of really interesting, useful thing. I think his critique of kind of the centering of knowing in an individual person, this very enlightenment way of thinking about how to do theology, how to know things, being contextualized in the life of the church, being contextualized in the life of this sort of embodied community of Christ. That's a really useful, fruitful way he's addressing his heritage. But I also think when we think about the view from below or above, we also see some of the limitations in his thought. Gustavo Gutierrez has this really great essay that I draw off in my chapter, where he talks about the view from below and says that just naming the view from below isn't the same thing as analyzing it. Just naming something like the presence of God in the suffering isn't the same thing as working to alleviate the suffering of the suffering, right? Where I think that's helpful, though, is that Bonhoeffer's limitations are also my own. And by mine or our limitations, I mean people who look like me, right? We're educated, white, Western, middle-class folk who still tend to overpopulate theology today. So we might be tempted to just leave behind the insights of white male theologians like Bonhoeffer. And I think, you know, there's a good case to be made that we should do that. And we should also learn from a far wider range of experiences and people. But I also think that in coming to Bonhoeffer, I sort of interrogate myself, right? His limitations are my limitations. And so by studying him, for all the good and the bad, I get a better picture of how I might be, you know, how I might speak in the welcome of age today, as a settler person, as a white person, and so on.
In the chapter, you also make reference to the Church of England missionary Samuel Marsden and his first encounter with the Maori people. What happened in this encounter, and how does it relate to your recognition of Bonhoeffer's view from below actually being from above?
Samuel Marsden was this key clerical and political figure in quite a lot of early Australian and New Zealand colonial history. In particular, Marsden's this figure. He worked for the Church Missionary Society. He was also sort of a founding rector at the first Anglican parish in Australia. And he's particularly credited as being the person who brought the gospel to New Zealand. The arrival of the gospel in New Zealand is sort of how his life is often narrated. He initially lived in Parramatta, which is where I now live in Western Sydney. But he developed this relationship with a Maori leader called Ruatara. And through his relationship to Ruatara, traveled from Parramatta to New Zealand. So there's kind of some interesting genealogical connections even there in my own sort of story. He arrived in a place called Rangihoia, and he delivered a Christmas sermon. This is in 1814. And the church in New Zealand has long told a story about this Christmas sermon as an arrival of the good news. Marsden preached his sermon from the opening of Luke's gospel, you know, "Behold, I bring you good news of great joy." And the story is that Māori were so overjoyed with this news of salvation that they responded to Marsden's sermon with a haka. I hope fans of rugby know sort of what that would look like, right? This kind of traditional form of engaging, particularly a guest, someone who you're welcoming into your land. There's this different story to be told, however, about Marsden, a different story that I think will help illustrate this idea of speaking from below, from above, pretty well. And I'm drawing particularly here off these two educationalists in New Zealand. One of them is Maori, one of them's a white settler. They're called Alison Jones and Kurika Jenkins, if anyone's interested. And they contend that what really happened wasn't a sermon, wasn't a Christmas message. It wasn't a sort of discernibly British Christian thing at all. What happened was a porphyry, a process of Maori welcome, of intermingling of political relations, a hui, a gathering in which discussion takes place and about, you know, what to do. Where Marsden thinks he's come to deliver a sermon, which Maori responds to, it's far more likely that Maori themselves are sort of the ones dictating this encounter, right? Marsden's this sole figure arriving onto this foreign shore. He's speaking English. He doesn't really speak much Te Reo Māori. He doesn't speak much Māori language. It's not really likely that Marsden is the center of the story. It's much more likely that the indigenous hosts are the actual center of that story. And so when we tell the story in different ways, we kind of can see what it's like to speak from history from above or from below. Telling history from above centers Marsden and centers his experiences in the story. It centers his very British, his quite Anglican form of Christianity that Marsden brought with him. It's of course natural that Marsden, as a British Christian, brought with him a form of British Christianity. But the mistake that Marsden makes is that he assumes that form of Christianity is the only way there is, one that is ordained by God, and that there is no other way. But when we shift the story to tell it from below or something to that effect, we see that the story is really about the indigenous hosts of this encounter. The focus is on Māori and the experiences of Māori in this context. We see that it's not some encounter between a white savior coming to fulfill the empty heads of an indigenous people, but a guest welcomed into a context in which his ideas could be shared and discussed, determined by the people of that land. And this is what Jones and Carl Jenkins point out. We've paid a lot of attention to this first story in our past, a lot of attention to the arrival of Marsden preaching this message of good news. We've paid very little attention to this second story. Indigenous communities across the world have been living the second story for a long time, and they've certainly been paying attention to it. But the white settler majorities, which you know I come from, and the white settler Christians, which made up the communities that I still exist within, haven't really ever paid attention to that story. In fact, they've seen that story as not just something not worthy of listening from, but something as, you know, similar to something demonic, something that needs to be cast out, something that needs to be replaced, something that needs to be exorcised from the faith. This is sort of one way of passing out how Bonhoeffer's ideas of the view from below or from above might help us read our own histories and might help us pay better attention to where God is working in the world around us.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to situate the conversation around Bonhoeffer and colonialism within a concrete example, especially when you look at Bonhoeffer's idea of like Christ's reality, that there is one reality that we engage with. And by situating Bonhoeffer's theology in the particular situation of settler colonialism is really important. And I think even there, obviously there's a historical example of Samuel Marsden, but if we're taking a more recent example, there was the recent Indigenous voice vote in Australia. So do you see this analysis of settler theology relating to this in any way?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots to be said about the Indigenous voice in Australia. There's lots to be said about what it is, why it's needed, why it failed. And to be very clear as well, I'm by no means an expert on it. So I think I'd kind of want to offer this, and this is a phrase that a lot of Indigenous folk here in Australia often say, just another day in the colony. We tend to think of colonization as something that happened in the past, and white people in particular are taught as something, empire and colonialism is you know, something that happened a long time ago. I think that the not just the fact that the referendum failed, not just the fact that it didn't get through in the particular structure that it tried to get through, but also the general wider response, the general rhetoric around the idea that an indigenous representation at some sort of government level would be so offensive to so many, highlights the fact that there is no sort of post-colonial reality in Australia or New Zealand for that matter. It's just another day in the colony, right?
Yeah, no, thank you for those reflections, and it's been a really enjoyable conversation. But if people are wanting to engage with your work or connect with you, where can they find you online?
Twitter is probably the best way. At AD Clark Howard is my handle. Send me a message there. I'd love to talk more. William has very, very kindly highlighted some of the work that I've published and therefore been one of the very few readers who've read it. So that's also another place if you really wanted to go. But yeah, Twitter is probably the best way to look me up, and keen to hear what people think.
Yeah, I will link your other articles in the podcast notes because obviously a lot of our listeners are students themselves, so we'll have institutional access to those. So I would encourage you to read them. I definitely enjoyed them. So yes, thank you again for coming on today, Andrew.
Thank you so much, William. It's been super great to chat. Yeah.